It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this week, the Sauk County Board of Supervisors voted to sell its Reedsburg nursing home to a private company that owns three facilities in the Milwaukee area. The nonprofit Sauk County Healthcare Center opened in 2009. The county board voted to sell the facility to Aria Healthcare for just over $5 million. How will this transition into a for-profit business affect quality of care and staffing? And what does a sale convey about our state's long-term care offerings? To explore these questions, we turn to Rob Gunderman, president and CEO of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging and Health Groups. Rob, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
Good morning. How did you respond to this development that a county nursing home in southern Wisconsin is changing hands to a for-profit provider?
Well, it's disappointing, but this is a trend. And it's not just a trend in Wisconsin, it's a trend nationwide. So disappointing, but not surprising.
And so why is this a trend? What's behind it?
Well, and part of it is reimbursement rates are just not where they need to be. There isn't enough money going into the system, and that really needs to change. The Medicaid reimbursement rates just aren't meeting where they need to be.
And, you know, we saw in recent months the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services updating its Medicare payment policies and rates for nursing homes, increasing spending by over 4% in fiscal year 2025. What effect could that additional revenue have on nursing homes in Wisconsin?
I think it'll help. It's clearly not enough, but every bit helps. We're still not going to be anywhere near where we need to be. And for a nursing home, you know, when you're converting from non-for-profit to for-profit status, there are really only two ways you're going to generate profit. Either you're going to reduce your expenditures or you're going to increase your revenue. And typically what we're seeing is they decrease their revenue, or they decrease their services, you know, as part of that.
So what impact could that have on residents when a nursing home changes ownership like this?
Well, there are a lot of ways that it can impact the residents. And my first question is always when these transitions take place is, will everyone who's there currently be allowed to stay there? But aside from that, just the changes in staff ratios can really have a pretty dramatic impact on the quality of life and the quality of care for the patients. Having someone available to meet your needs when you need to go to the bathroom, when you ring that bell, or they responding to you quickly. That's all really important stuff.
Well, let's take these issues one at a time. Nursing home eviction, is that an issue in Wisconsin?
It can be when they do these transitions, they don't have to keep Medicaid patients. So that becomes one of the questions. And it typically in Wisconsin, the way it's worked over the years has been facilities will allow you to stay if you can private pay for a few years, and then you transition onto Medicaid. They would frequently let you stay. I'm not sure how many of these for-profits are allowing that to continue. And that's a big question I have.
In terms of staffing levels, would a for-profit then just follow the state, federal, regulations for the number of staff that they have to have?
Yeah, and typically it's the minimum. When the for-profits typically have less or fewer staff and lower staff ratios than the nonprofits do.
So earlier this week, the Sauk County Board votes 18-13 to sell the nursing home. And at Tuesday's meeting, local residents were speaking out against the proposal at the meeting. And here's John Miller.
Just from my experience of going to the Sauk County Health Center, what a wonderful place it was. They used to do our training there. They used to take us around to see the people there. It's a great place. Deserves its 5-star rating, and it does not deserve to be sold to a private enterprise. Private enterprises are there for profit. They're not there for people.
And now, to be clear, Sauk County Health Center currently has a 3-star rating from the Medicare Quality Rating System. Rob, should we assume that nonprofit or county facilities provide better care than for-profit facilities?
And they tend to. They really do. And the thing about these county nonprofit nursing homes is a lot of time that's where someone who has failed out other places ends up. And it's sort of a place of last resort. Take a dementia patient who has become aggressive or difficult to handle and facility just can't handle them anymore where they're at. Then they send them to these county facilities that are usually able to deal with them. So there's a real need for them, and it's concerning that we're losing them.
We're talking about privatizing nursing homes and the long-term care industry in Wisconsin with Rob Gunderman, president and CEO of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging and Health Groups. Rob, before the sale officially goes through, ARIA would need to receive a license to operate from the state's Bureau of Nursing Home Resident Care. Do you see any challenges there in receiving final approval for the sale?
I don't know about that. I do think it's really important, though, that we have more regulatory oversight when these transitions take place. But I don't know in that particular case.
Another thing we heard at this meeting was about where to reallocate the money that was going to the county nursing home facility. And board members who supported the sale said the money previously spent on the county nursing home would then be reallocated to programs like the Aging and Disability Resource Center and Meals on Wheels and other county programs. And that reporting, by the way, from the Baraboo News Republic. How would you propose funding to be reallocated, or what do you make of that type of reallocation?
I mean, I think that's great, and those are all very important services and very worthwhile, but it doesn't replace what we're losing. That's the problem.
So just putting them into different organizations that support senior citizens isn't enough to replace what is happening at a long-term care facility.
Right. That doesn't provide them with a bed.
Now, I'm going to step out here for a moment. Earlier this summer, Catholic nonprofit SSM Health announced it is selling 3 long-term care facilities to a nonprofit company that's based in New Jersey. What stands out to you in nursing homes changing ownership in Wisconsin? You mentioned here you're seeing some trends.
It's hard for nursing homes to operate. I mean, honestly, it's a difficult business to get into. 10% of nursing facilities have closed in Wisconsin since 2016. So I think there's some difficulty there. But Wisconsin is an aging state. 19% of our residents are 65 and older. That figure has increased by 34% since 2010, and it's projected to continue. So we're going to have a need for nursing homes.
You also point out there's this trend in the establishment of community-based residential facilities in lieu of traditional nursing homes. What is the difference between the two?
Well, the community-based residential facility shouldn't be providing as much care. If you need a certain level of skilled nursing, you're supposed to be in a nursing home. But community-based living facilities are really nice because they cost less, and for people who don't need that skilled nursing, it can be a great alternative. But they aren't regulated the same way that nursing homes are. They aren't regulated through the federal government the way the nursing homes are. So it's a little bit different. They don't require CNAs. CNAs have more training. They use what are called typically resident assistants who don't have nearly as much training as a CNA does. They don't, they're not able to give medications and things like that. So those are really for people who don't need the level of care that you would be requiring in a nursing home.
Looking at some national numbers here, for-profit companies have been buying up nursing homes across the country. And there was a 2022 study by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For-profits now own about 72% of the more than 15,000 nursing homes nationwide. Do you anticipate that number to grow?
I do. I think that will grow. That's just the trend that we're seeing, unfortunately. But if we can keep a number of those nonprofit, especially those county-owned nonprofit nursing homes in existence, it can really help.
How would you suggest counties keep their facilities going, especially if they are really cash-strapped, they have really tight budgets? What do you suggest?
I mean, government has to put more money into this. That's just the reality. And we're going to spend more money on our aging population. And the only question is what trajectory that spending, that increase of spending is going to look like. And, you know, by planning ahead, we can do this in a more nuanced way where we aren't spending as much as we would otherwise. But there are other things that they can do. It's not just the funding that's the issue. The staff retention is a big problem. And part of the issue there is typically, you know, staff CNAs don't feel that they have a real ability to advance. And there are things we could do there. We could create a certified dementia specialist position. You know, an awful lot of the folks in nursing homes have dementia, and that would give them, you know, an ability to get some more training and advance. I think there are things like that we could do. It's not just the finances that are the problem, although that's probably the biggest one.
So really seeing a path forward from certified nursing assistant to other positions in the care, in nursing care and support.
Exactly. And, you know, it's about a couple of things there. One, you're giving the employee the tools they need to be successful at their job, but you're also giving them new tools, and those new tools improve the quality of care and the quality of life for the residents. And those are tools that they can share with the other staff. So it builds upon itself.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your analysis.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Rob Gunderman is president and CEO of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging and Health Groups. He was with us to talk about the Sauk County Board's vote this week to sell their county nursing home to a for-profit provider and other issues that long-term care facilities are facing around the state. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out why the state has a shortage of automotive technicians and how a community college is working to train the next generation of mechanics.
And we're helping to spark this interest in the automotive field.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Courting women voters is not a new concept, but in recent years, new political groups on the left and the right have sprouted up with the goal of appealing to moms. Corrine Hess has more on two very different groups trying to sway the votes of Wisconsin's mothers.
The main events of the Republican National Convention took place at the Pfizer Forum in Milwaukee, but one of the hottest tickets of the week was a half mile away at the Bradley Symphony Center. On the second day of the July convention, the conservative activist group Moms for Liberty filled the 2,500-seat hall. In a video message, former President Donald Trump kicks off the event by mocking what Moms for Liberty's adversaries have said about it.
You're a hate group. You hate your children, you hate everybody.
Moms for Liberty has been a controversial group, but also a successful one. The group now boasts 130,000 members in 48 states. There are 14 chapters in Wisconsin. Its success is just the latest example of how political parties are trying to target women with issues around families, schools, and security. Amber Schrader is the vice chair of Moms for Liberty, Ozaukee County. She says moms are fed up, awake, and activated.
So now they're saying, hold on a second, it's affecting me. It's affecting my life. It's affecting my finances. It's affecting my safety. And most importantly, it's affecting my family. And so they're coming out and they're voting, and we're welcoming them with open arms.
Moms for Liberty says their mission is parental choice. The group is currently fighting against the new Title IX rules that protect transgender students. 4 years ago, Schrader says she was a stay-at-home mom who barely knew who Wisconsin's governor was. But then COVID hit, and she didn't like what she saw.
And it really opened up a lot of people's eyes to what was actually going on within our school districts. And they had been taken over. Our school districts had been taken over.
While Moms for Liberty is trying to organize conservative women, another Wisconsin group is trying to do the same for liberal women. During the Democratic National Convention, Kate Duffy of the Wisconsin-based Motherhood for Good took to Instagram to interview prominent Democratic politicians.
Hello, this is Kate from Motherhood for Good, and we are here with the chair of the Wisconsin Democrats, Ben Wickler. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm so good.
Since launching 2 years ago, the Motherhood for Good Instagram page has amassed more than 20,000 followers. Duffy says Motherhood for Good is aiming to organize voters in Wisconsin to vote for Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris.
We're focusing on the women who have either not voted in the past, not paid attention, or always just kind of like voted maybe what their dad or husband talked about. They have power and they have a voice.
Duffy says the U.S. Supreme Court's 2020 decision overturning federal abortion rights was one of the key reasons she wanted to get involved in politics.
It was a lot of emotions. It was fear, anger, disgust, just some of those bad emotions aren't necessarily bad for, like, getting up and getting involved.
Targeting moms is not new to politics. As far back as 1996, the news media identified, quote, soccer moms as one of the demographics that helped reelect President Bill Clinton. Kelly Dittmar is the director of research at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. She says moms have never been a single voting bloc, and they are even more diverse in their voting preferences this year than in past years.
And I think you can see that in the activism and advocacy of women's and mothers' organizations that really come to the table with, yes, leveraging their identity as mothers, but to very different ends and with very different policy perspectives.
Over the next 7 weeks, Moms for Liberty and Motherhood for Good will continue reaching out to women. Both groups hope their messages will connect with Wisconsin's moms. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. If you've taken your vehicle in for repairs lately and had a longer wait than you expected, you're not alone. The auto repair industry is dealing with a worker shortage, and it's leading to longer backlogs at some Wisconsin auto shops. Vehicle repair costs are also rising, with the Consumer Price Index showing a nearly 20% increase from 2023 to 2024. Shop owners say they're having trouble finding enough qualified technicians, and enrollment in post-secondary programs was steadily declining for years before it started to bounce back in 2022. Tyson Larson is an automotive technician instructor at Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore. He talked to Rob Ferret earlier this week.
What kind of things are you hearing lately from repair shops that you talk to about the auto technician workforce these days?
So what I'm hearing from our workforce, that would include the partners we have in our advisory committee and just independent shops and dealerships in our areas, that they're having difficulty finding technicians, and whether it be skilled technicians or just even technicians coming out right out of school, just having difficulty finding qualified technicians that actually want to work and are motivated to want to work and then learn more about automobiles and how to repair them.
Well, as we're talking, I understand you're literally on break from teaching some of the auto technicians of the future. What has enrollment been like in your program at Southwest Wisconsin Tech?
So enrollment actually in our program has been stable the last few years. Now, overall across the country, compared to what it was 10 years ago, we're about 14, 15% down from where we were roughly 10 years ago. I think part of it is the students aren't getting exposed as much anymore. And I think part of it is like a culture shift. So meaning you're not seeing the father and son, or, you know, the parent and child working on a vehicle anymore underneath the shade tree. We don't see that as much anymore. And the thing is, with the complexity of the vehicles, with having electronics and computers, modules, it's a lot more complicated than it used to be. So now the parent doesn't quite understand it because it's more complex and you need special tools to be able to diagnose this stuff now. So basically, since the parent maybe doesn't have the information, now they can't share that with the student or with the son. And on top of that, we're not seeing the training happening in the high schools either. So a lot of the programs are either getting underfunded or just flat out cut. And rightfully so, these programs are expensive to maintain with the tools and equipment required to run on automotive shop. It can be quite a challenge to offer that when you have limited budgets.
You are getting creative there at Southwest Technical College. You've got a Pistons to Pathways program that's trying to fill some of those gaps you just described. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so and that's what we've done. And this is really why we've had fairly stable student enrollment, is because now what we're doing is that we're thinking about the industry as a whole. So who are the people involved, right? So we got manufacturers, we got dealers, we have independent shops, we have the high schools. So we're working with the high schools and we're working with dealers. And what we did back in 2018 is we created this program, like you said, called Pistons to Pathways. And what that is an opportunity for the students to gain automotive skills while they're still in high school. So what these students do is they take one of our 3-credit courses to start with as a junior at the dealership level. So we have 4 sponsored locations right now at automotive dealerships. So high school students from in our district travel to a specific dealership on Wednesday night, and they are taught by a dealership technician. So they're taught by somebody who's completely trained and who is certified, and they have all the tools and equipment they need there. Now, we've also had to supplement some of the tools that they need for that class, but for the most part, these students take our 3-credit maintenance class at the dealerships. They're getting that experience. It's helping them gain some confidence, and we're helping to spark this interest in the automotive field.
Talking to Tyson Larson, automotive technician instructor at Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore, looking at a shortage and maybe a worse future shortage of auto technicians may affect your wait times if you're getting your car fixed. Tyson, I want to follow up on something you mentioned earlier. Cars, more complicated. It used to be if you were a mechanic, you were mostly doing auto mechanic stuff. Now you're still doing that. Plus, you're an electronics engineer and maybe a little bit of computer science scientist rolled in. How much more complicated is it to learn how to fix the range of cars out there in the country now?
Well, the funny thing is this program at Southwest Tech was 2 years long in 1967, and it's 2024, and the program's still 2 years long. And as you know, we've got more complex with the hybrid electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles. So the complexity is really high. I mean, we're really car doctors. The amount of knowledge that's required for us to know and understand is really high. So the bar is set pretty high. But what's happening is that because our program is only 2 years long, well, we can only cover so much information. So are we getting the software infotainment system? Yes, but we're really just scratching the surface. You see, when students graduate here, they're really just entry level. And because they're entry level, once they go out and work at a facility, whether it be independent shop or at a dealership, they have to basically start their training again. So the challenge with this industry is that there's this large expectation for students to come right out of school with some high level skills. And while they do come out with some high-level skills because we have quality instructors here and we do an excellent job with them, there's just so much experience that is needed, and there's quite a skills gap that exists.
Now, for that entry-level technician, what is the pay like? Is this part of the story of why somebody might think twice about going into it as they look at what they get paid when they're first in the industry?
Yes, that's definitely one of the high ones on the list. So, as I mentioned before, just having the exposure is an issue, but also the pay is such a large issue. So just to give you an example, so we have programs here that students can graduate and make in the $30 to $40 an hour range just right out of the gate. And for automotive technicians, now it really varies based on location, but it can be in the $15 to $20 an hour range that they're starting. And not only that, on top of that, because we're technicians, we're required to have a special set of tools. So when you're in this industry, you're expected to be able to work on cars, but you have to have your own tools to do so. And the challenge with that is there aren't a whole lot of industries that you can think of where, as an employee, you need to come in with $5,000 to $10,000 worth of tools. You see, I think that's pretty overwhelming, because to have $10,000 worth of tools and then go start at an independent shop or a dealership where they're telling you, well, your skills aren't worth the pay you're asking, but yet you had to spend $10,000 on your tools.
And we'll leave it there. Tyson, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yep. Thank you.
Tyson Larson is an automotive technician instructor at Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore. He was with us today to talk about what's driving a shortage of auto mechanics, what he's hearing from students getting into the industry. Now let's visit a Wisconsin auto shop for a firsthand look at the issue. Nick Robinson is the manager of J&S Auto Care in Janesville. Nick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Absolutely.
All right. I keep hearing, Nick, from people who run mechanic shops around the state having trouble bringing on staff. Is this something you're seeing at your shop and from other colleagues in the Janesville area?
I guess, you know, I really don't have any affiliations with other shops in town here, but I know, you know, everybody's kind of short on technicians, ourself included. I mean, it's gotten to the point where we haven't even tried to hire anybody. I think the last person we had hired back was in 2019, but it's just myself, the owner, and a mechanic that's been with us for about 35 years here now. So,
and what are the challenges of bringing a new technician on board at a shop?
I guess the hard part is either they've been trained through a technical college and they, you know, expect to be paid more than my guy that's been here for 35 years right off the bat, and you know, without any real world experience, you know, so if they can't plug a computer into a car and it doesn't tell them, you know, exactly what to do, they really don't know what to do beyond whatever the scan tool is telling them, because they haven't had that experience in the field yet. Otherwise, you know, beyond the pay issue there, and the experience, you know, the other guys you get are the inexperienced, you know, not trained or school technicians that are coming in and willing to learn. But I feel like the ones that we've hired of those people, we have spent more time almost babysitting and correcting mistakes than it's worth having on, you know, as a staff member here.
Has the job gotten more complicated as we get to vehicles that have more and more sensors and computers and electronic features?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're to the point that Chrysler has been bought out by, you know, companies over the years, and the Stellantis that they're currently owned by, I mean, that any vehicles, Chrysler-type vehicles, 2018 and newer, they basically have us locked out of them. I mean, we can pay to get on certain subscriptions and be able to log in and see data, but for just the average guy, I mean, they have you locked out of it, so you can't even get in to see their data. But yeah, the newer the cars get, the more overly complicated they get. With everything going hybrid and electric, you know, it leaves my mechanics not familiar with those systems. You know, we're basically just used to working on combustion engines and regular electronics, and everything's gone to high-speed data networks, CAN bus networks, and makes everything much more difficult for the average guy to be able to take on himself.
Now, I talked to somebody from a technical college, Southwest Technical College, who said, you know, we're do our best to send students out, train for the world, but it's been a two-year program for the last 20 years. You got to pack everything into those 2 years. Are there things you'd like to see change when it comes to training, whether we're talking about high school students, technical colleges, apprenticeships, whatever?
Well, I mean, one thing that I guess I've heard recently from a few people is that, you know, school teachers and stuff that are my customers, that they are starting to bring back some of the automotive programs and woodworking programs and things like that in the high schools that they had taken away in previous years just because they didn't have the budget to be able to continue those programs. I think having that, you know, interest in the field earlier, you know, when you're a high school student and you don't have money, you have to learn how to fix your own stuff. And being able to get some experience in high school would get more people in the interested, you know, moving forward, going to a technical college or maybe trying to find, you know, a shop that would be willing to take them in as kind of an apprentice and train them along the way. But, you know, I feel over the last, probably 10 years or so, you know, that field has just been dying off. There's less and less people that are interested in it when they can stay at home and do stuff on their computer and make just as much, if not more money, working from home and not having to leave that computer screen or really physically do anything. I guess I feel like there's less people that are willing to do the physical aspects of the job than there were, you know, 10 years ago or more.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for taking the time.
Very good. Well, I appreciate having us on.
Nick Robinson is the manager of J&S Auto Care in Janesville. He talked with Rob Ferret earlier this week, giving his views on a shortage of auto technicians. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, phantom towns exist on maps, but in the real world?
There still might be an old building or something like that there, so they're interesting from that perspective, but they're certainly not places where you could stop for gas or cappuccino or something like that.
And what happened when a Wisconsin community was left off of a state map? That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Plenty of cities and towns in Wisconsin have their claims to fame. Maybe an iconic product is made there, or one of their residents reached celebrity status. But only one community can say that it chose to break away from the state of Wisconsin. And that is Winneconne, a village near Oshkosh. In 1967, in response to a map-making error, it declared itself a sovereign state, something residents still gather to celebrate every July. Wisconsin Today producer Colleen Leahy traveled to Winneconne during this year's Sovereign State Days to learn more about its history.
I had no trouble at all finding Winneconne.
In a quarter mile, turn right onto US 151 North, East Washington Avenue.
I didn't get lost once on the nearly two-hour drive from my house in Madison to the small town on the shores of Lake Winneconne and the Wolf River.
Your destination is on the left.
But I probably shouldn't brag about how easy it was for me to find it. Winneconneans are a bit sensitive about the subject.
Because we were left off the map.
That's Jordan Dunham, president of Winneconne Sovereign State Board. You heard that right. Sovereign State Board. We'll get there.
It all started back in 1967. When a salesman from Milwaukee came to town, and he was complaining that he couldn't find Winneconne on the map.
It turned out this traveling salesman wasn't just bad at directions. Winneconne was actually not on the map. This was in 1967, before GPS. People had to use actual physical maps. And a lot of people, especially people who liked to fish, wanted to get to Winneconne.
Because, you know, we are a fishing village, Andy. People couldn't see us on the map. They didn't know where to go.
So Vera Kitchen, who was president of the Winneconne Chamber of Commerce, wrote a letter to the governor of Wisconsin, Warren P. Knowles, where she requested that Winneconne be put back on the map. But his response was less than satisfactory. Governor Knowles wrote that during the printing process, the name of Winneconne was, quote,
obliterated.
And the mistake just wasn't caught during proofreading. Quote,
the safeguards have been established to prevent such occurrences in the future. It will definitely appear on the 1968 map.
That was not good enough for Winneconne. So?
We seceded from the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Seceded from the state of Wisconsin.
That's Winneconne in a nutshell. If we can do something, we're going to do it, essentially. They're going to have fun and make it a fun event. So.
That's Christina Williams. She's lived in Winneconne for 4 years. I talked to her at the annual Sovereign State Days Parade. It's part of a 4-day extravaganza that's been going on for nearly 60 years. This year, it featured a magic show, a meat raffle, a softball tournament, a 5K run, a petting zoo, a motorcycle ride, bounce houses, just to name a few. All to celebrate the town's secession from the state of Wisconsin on July 21st, 1967, which, all in all, lasted either several minutes or exactly 1 minute, depending on who you ask. But if you really want to understand the Winneconne mindset, you have to look at their flag.
You can see this is a dodo bird. That was Sovereign State's bird. My name is Mary Lou Schrader. I am on the board of the Winneconne Historical Society. Down there is poison ivy. So that's our flower. Over here is a stinky skunk. That's our animal. And down there is our fish, which is a sheephead. They're just not a liked fish. So they picked all unlikable things. And of course, in the middle, it's got Sovereign State of Winneconne. We like it where? Because we weren't on the map. So that's how that slogan started.
The great PR stunt slash practical joke that is Sovereign State Days took a lot of people to get off the ground. But there is one person in particular who's really important in this history. Remember that letter to Governor Knowles demanding that Winneconne be put back on the map? The woman who wrote that letter, president of the Winneconne Chamber of Commerce, born and raised in Winneconne, was Vera Kitchen.
It was all her idea. She spearheaded the entire thing. My name is Kay Larson, and I am Vera's niece. Vera was definitely a woman ahead of her time. She was a leader in every aspect of life.
She was a very strong-willed, firecracker, creative person. My name is Lori Meyerhofer Fisher, and I am Vera Kitchen's niece.
Vera's nieces both told me she was the kind of person who had boundless energy. She was always working.
She owned an ice cream shop.
She was also a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse.
She owned a restaurant.
She ran that herself and did everything herself.
She owned a gas station.
She would change oil and tires and, yeah.
And on top of all that, Vera was the self-appointed custodian and prime minister of the kitchen cabinet of the sovereign state of Winneconne.
She just had one of those minds that she could see things, like that vision with sovereign state, that whole thing. I mean, you look at that time in 67, how many women were even in that realm?
Vera Kitchen died in 2012. She was 98. After I went to the Sovereign State Parade, there was one more thing I wanted to see. But I quickly realized that I couldn't find it.
No luck. I'm starting to feel afraid that maybe I walked past it.
Just like that traveling salesman back in 1967, I was lost.
We got Kemp, we got Nimmer, we got McDonald, we got Briggs. I am looking for a kitchen. Where is she?
Almost everyone I met in Winneconne told me they love their community because of the small town feel. Everywhere you go, there's a kind face. Everyone knows everyone. And when I did finally find what I was looking for...
I found it! I found it! I found it! I found it! Vera Wenzel Kitchen, born March 25th, 1914, died October 3rd, 2012.
I wish that everyone in Winneconne, and that I, had the chance to know Vera, too.
Her gravestone says, "What's next? I am ready." Oh, so cool.
For Wisconsin Today, I'm Colleen Leahy.
A special thanks to Sarah Hopeful for technical direction on that piece, and to Lee Rayburn for being the voice of Governor Warren P. Knowles. Now, it's one thing to be left off of a map like Winneconne was. What about being put on the map when there's nothing there? The State Cartographer's Office is currently documenting phantom locations that are on maps of the state but aren't actual communities. Howard Berrigan is Wisconsin State Cartographer at UW-Madison. He talked with my co-host, Rob Ferret, earlier this week.
Now, one project you've got going on fits in well with our story we've heard about Winneconne disappearing briefly from a map. You are looking in the other direction, looking at unincorporated communities in the state, some of which still exist, some don't, maybe some never existed. Talk us through that saga.
Sure. So, you're talking about unincorporated places as well as cartographic phantoms, or at least that's what we call them. So unincorporated places are simply typically small rural locales where there might be a few homes, and there's typically some sort of sign that says, yes, this is a place called whatever. Cartographic phantoms, on the other hand, are places, often unincorporated places, that have disappeared for one reason or another, often because the population moved away, the tavern burnt down on the corner, and so there was, you know, people didn't congregate there anymore. Sometimes because the place was miscoded on a map, and it was actually something more akin to a railroad crossing, but was shown on a map as being a community. So a lot of these cartographic phantoms, when you show up in that locale now, there's really nothing there at all, even though you'll find them on maps and even though you'll find them looking on your iPhone, looking at Apple Maps or Google Maps.
There's got to be a lot of fascinating stories. I wonder if some of these are maybe wishful thinking, like I'm a land speculator and Rob's Corners is the town of the future. And well, it never came to be, but the name stayed on a map somewhere.
That is absolutely true. There are cases like that where towns were settled and platted and people were hoping to make scads of money. And then the railroad, you know, passed 5 miles to the south and the, you know, village pretty much disappeared.
On a practical level, you mentioned this might show up on an online Google Map, Apple Map, whatever. One worry is people are driving along and saying, oh, I'm almost to Rob's Corners. Maybe we can stop for gas there. Well, Rob's Corners is just the intersection of two roads with maybe farmland here and a forest there.
Exactly right. And that's one of the reasons that for the project that we're working on at the State Cartographer's Office. We don't want to remove these places from the map, per se. We want to reclassify them so that they do show up as historical locales, perhaps. There still might be an old building or something like that there, so they're interesting from that perspective. But they're certainly not places where you could stop for gas or cappuccino or something like that.
And I love that part of the effort. You're not looking to pull out the eraser and take these places off the map. You want to preserve that history. Why is that important for you?
Well, it's important from the standpoint of both history as well as the standpoint of cartography. I mean, one of the purposes of maps is to record and document what is there on the ground. So simply erasing something from the map because it's a place that used to exist that doesn't exist now isn't really an appropriate thing to do. You may not show it on every map. You know, your map may not be appropriate to show historical places, but you don't necessarily want to erase them simply from, you know, from history or from memory.
Now, I've heard, I don't know if this is cartographic legend or not, I've heard that sometimes mistakes are introduced into maps intentionally for plagiarism reasons, copyright reasons. Is that something that actually happens?
It does. It's probably not as widespread as the myths would suggest. Those are sometimes called copyright traps. And in the past, they were introduced into some maps to, if you know, so that if a competitor copied your map, they copied the place that didn't exist, and you'd know that they did it. So it does happen.
And now do you – I saw on the State Cartographer website, you've got some pictures of these cartographic phantoms where somebody has gone to the place on the map where it's supposed to be and – observe the lack of community there.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because there's a couple of us who have been doing this research. Personally, I've visited probably over 1,000 of these either unincorporated places, which do exist, or cartographic phantoms, which don't. Every county in the state, aside from Milwaukee, has cartographic phantoms and unincorporated places in them. So our goal is to simply go to these places and take a geotagged photograph, like on an iPhone, because that gives us the latitude and longitude, and it gives us the documentation of, yes, there's a place here, or here's the sign on the road that says it's Rob's Corners. So we've been to numerous places like this, and just trying to document their existence or non-existence, I guess you could say.
Something huge in the world of maps in my lifetime, your lifetime, paper, right? I used to have a paper map when I went anywhere, or a triptych or whatever, and now we've gone digital. What are your thoughts, the advantages and maybe some of the things we lose when we change that?
So there are certainly implications of the loss of paper maps. It's good and bad, I would say. It's a huge question also. I mean, it's hard to answer. That's really a thesis or a dissertation or something. But I do believe that people have probably lost some of the abilities that we used to have for really deeply understanding how maps work and reading maps and so on. On the other hand, everybody's got a map in their pocket now. And as somebody who loves maps, I have to say, well, that's a good thing because people are interacting with maps on a day-to-day basis, which is something that they didn't necessarily do 15 or 20 years ago.
Now, on the daily basis, what we're interacting with maps for is to figure out how to go from here to there. That is just a small fraction of the kind of information, though, we get from maps. Can you give us a taste? Like, I often wish, and maybe there are maps, like, how many cows are there per unit of area in this county or whatever, a sense of the kind of information we can convey best in map form.
Well, another huge question, and, where do you begin? another one of the transformations that's really happened over the last 15 to 25 years is the growth of geographic information systems as a way of storing and analyzing geographical information. And, back in the days of paper maps, it wasn't necessarily that easy to answer questions like that. Mm-hmm. But now it's relatively easy to take a map showing, the number of cattle density per area and then overlaying that with some geographical unit that you're interested in, some sort of boundaries, parcel boundaries or municipal boundaries to do those sort of what-if questions. So the application spans a very wide range from all of the disciplines that you could imagine at UW-Madison, for example. Many of them are now coming into the kind of the realm of geographic information systems, and that includes everybody from public health to, engineering and geology, and environmental science is huge in this area, geography, sociology, even history and the humanities. Mm-hmm. You can analyze historical texts to extract the geographical information from them and create visual displays of what this particular novel looked like in the mind of the author. So it's kind of, like I said, endless or limitless the uses you can apply geographic information systems to.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Absolutely.
Howard Berrigan is the Wisconsin State Cartographer at UW-Madison. We talked with him about the world of Wisconsin mapmaking and his team's efforts to document cartographic phantoms in the state's maps. For more on the past and future of mapmaking, check out To the Best of Our Knowledge. They recently aired their own episode on the subject. You can find that at ttbook.org. My colleagues here on Wisconsin Today know that I love to ask a certain question when we're pitching new books to discuss on the show. I will ask, well, who's the publisher? Who's the publisher? And tomorrow, we're going to talk with two independent publishers in Wisconsin about the industry and their work to raise the profile of Midwestern authors. And we'd like to hear from you. If you follow particular publishers and have stories you want to share about the publishing industry, do drop us a line. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also get in touch with us by text or leave us a voicemail, and that number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. And thanks for sharing your thoughts. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.